competition forces them to rapidly adapt, or they're going to be left behind.
Yes.
When I look at our other social structures, particularly, even though they were very well-meaning, when they became more socialist, that's probably too strong a word, when our government ran more institutions, public education, other fundamental things, health care, whatever it is that they Medicare, basically you have a single institution without competition.
Well,
is that part of a problem? Is that when you have only one institution, there's really no motive?
Well, there's no diversity. And I think diversity is the key to what we need to create.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's not, I believe in the market 100%, but not 1,000%.
Right.
There are things that governments need to do that companies can never do.
Right.
That's fine. That's fine. But the point is that governments are the worst bureaucracies. But the bureaucratic form of organization, top-down, hierarchical, everybody's familiar with this system, that made very good sense when you were running a society and an economy based on factory, rote and repetitive activity to produce products. That made perfectly good sense. It was efficient. But it ain't efficient today. It's counter-efficient. And yet, when we have a problem, the first thing we do is build a bureaucracy to solve it. And the most egregious case is the Department of Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm.
We take 15 or maybe some count as 20 or 22 small intelligence bureaucracies in the government, and we pile on top of one another to create one huge bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you talk to the people inside the department, they'll say, no, we're fighting bureaucracy. We are we're the opposite of bureaucracy. But in fact, they are the bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think bureaucracy it made very good sense when you lived in an orderly world based on mass production, rote and repetitive work, muscle labor rather than mind labor, with low requirements for new ideas and creativity and innovation. We're living in a world which is just the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
We need innovation. We need creativity. We need all the things that bureaucracies crush. So the next phase of this transformation, that's as we point out in Revolutionary Wealth, it's not just a question of do we have better technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's do we have a more advanced social structure to go along with the advanced technology.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to creating that, while we are way behind, I think that other countries are even further behind and will have an even harder time.
Do you think we need to somehow be able to attract the Bill Gateses of the world into leading those other institutions?
Oh, that's a very good idea. Yeah, I think that is a good idea. No, but I thought you also were going to say invite the creative and innovative people from outside the United States to help make the changes here. The answer is yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well,
much as Silicon Valley was, in fact, the entrepreneurs were foreigners very often, at Intel and other major companies. We brought in people, brains from all over the world, and we should be doing that. We should be keeping those brains as best we can.
Well, if you thought I was going to say that and it's a good idea, then that was what I was going to say. I'll take that as advice if that's the way I'm thinking. This is just an honor for me to get to even talk about some of these issues with you tonight. I want to ask you another very deep question on a different topic, but I first want to mention to our listeners that you're listening to WRFN LP Pasquo 98.9 FM in the greater Nashville area on the Future Quake Show with Dr. Future and our guest, Alvin Toffler. And we are talking about all matters of the future with our premier futurist here joining us tonight. Just jumping right in, I want to talk to you about something that to me is very disconcerting, and that's what's going on regarding the biological revolution, because I feel like the stakes are a lot higher and more fundamental. We've had several different shows that have touched on various aspects with experts in the field about human-animal hybrids, such as chimeras.
Right.
Most people are not aware of what's even in the published literature, what universities are doing. A lot of these are being done in laboratories in the Caribbean. For some reason, MIT and others are doing a lot of this work. They have a little bit more freedom to push the envelope in some of these places. Where we have human-animal hybrids, we have animals with high-percentage human brains inside animals even today as we speak. We have another aspect, our artificially enhanced transhumans, where we're looking at actually boosting along the evolutionary process, I guess you might say, by adding all sorts of additional capabilities that go in a superhuman state. Groups like the United Nations are fully supportive of this. They have conferences and other forums to be able to promote this. And then we have another aspect, I guess what you could call the cyborg approach, which is to use electronic enhancement, computer-based enhancement of our capabilities in memory or other cognitive capabilities. And all these three dimensions are ongoing right now. And as I understand it from the various sources I've read, that we can see a pronounced impact on society with these various forms in as soon as the next decade. Now, they may be off as far as you were originally in your cloning estimates, but the steamroller of progress has picked up dramatically just in the recent years in this area. And I see this as being an extremely potentially disruptive technology advancement to all of our social structures and to all of us Homo sapiens. So I just wonder how you see this revolution playing out ultimately, and do we need to even consider, I know you're very supportive of science as a whole, mm-hmm. and that we need to be more trustworthy of science and where it leads us, but in areas like this, do we have any kind of role of at least tempering a little bit science's thirst for progress mm-hmm. in some of these areas so that our best interests for humanity are preserved?
Well, Heidi and I just had a big, big yelling argument about this. I read your paragraph.
I'm so sorry.
No, we enjoy it.
Were y'all yelling about me? Or
no, not about you,
other?
But
okay,
about the, precisely this issue that you raise. I guess I think the position we'd previously taken, we've been on both sides of this at one
yes.
time or another. I think probably the timing is that you cite is probably a bit early.
Yes.
It probably won't happen quite as soon. But I do think that you're living in a world, and no matter what we do, somebody else is going to do it.
Right.
And we're going to see these changes and experiments made, and we are, I think, going to begin to create something, some new species. And this is the biggest thing to have happened to the human race since the evolution of this species.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you about a wonderful book that early on got a hold of this, and it's a fabulous novel. It's a book by an author, unfortunately forgotten, a French author named Vercors, V-E-R-C-O-R-S. He was in the French Resistance during World War II,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote this novel in which the story goes as follows. An Australian anthropologist discovers another previously unpopulated by humans island in the South Pacific somewhere, and discovers a species of animal somewhere between the ape and the human, and that and notes that they're extremely intelligent. They're really smart animals. And somehow or other, some business guys in Australia discover them or learn about them, and they say, hey, these creatures are so smart, we could put them to work and not have to pay them.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did is essentially attempt or plan to enslave these animals and put them to work previously done by humans, by full humans, shall we say.
Right, right.
The hero of the novel is outraged at this because he believes that these creatures are, in fact, human. And the issue is, what is the definition of human? And he therefore takes a baby of this species and flies to London. In London, he kills the baby. And then he calls the police and says, I have committed murder. And the issue facing the court is it murder if you kill an animal, or is it not murder? Is it murder only if you kill a human? And was this creature human?
Mm.
And it is a fantastic novel, which touches right on this hot button.
Mm.
My view is that, as I said a moment ago, that we are going to make those kinds of changes and experiments, that there will be multiple, not just one, center of this. It'll be around the world. there'll be countries racing in this direction, and that probably there isn't a lot we can do. What we can do is set some global laws, some global standards that try to control this, but as I say, I don't think we can, in the end, stop it. And I would be very worried about trying to clamp down on advanced biological and genetic research. I would want that to advance as rapidly as possible at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a whole other development, another context in which to see this, and that is what I think is the ultimate convergence. It's the convergence, it's what we're going to do is redefine the term human being, at the very same time that we are redefining our planet, its place in the universe, and its place in the universe. And when you put these two together, you're talking about, I don't know what we're talking about.
Well, then after we do that, we'll get on to the really big stuff, right?
Yeah, what do we have for breakfast?
Yeah, that will only impact every institutional structure we have on this planet, from
every human
religion,
being and every creature.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which would actually make all of these other things we're talking about move.
Oh, look, trivial.
The last thing we'll be worrying about is immigration or where manufacturing is moving
to. I think this is the really big issue. This convergence is the really big issue, and I believe that it is the most likely to create war among us humans. And the reason for that, I think, is religion.
Mm-hmm.
That different religions will have different positions about these things.
Mm.
And there will be tremendous disagreements. And unfortunately, I think we'll see potentially wars as well.
What's ironic about that?
A war of morality with different definitions of morality and humanity.
The ironic part of it is that some of these religions, like Judaism and Christianity, at least in some of their sects, teach that this kind of activity happened in the ancient past, and that it actually forced God's hand to stop the activity. All the teachings of the great floods and things like that. There are many who believe, if you read the narrative in there, that actually these activities were going on and forced God's hand. So that thinking is going to motivate their actions in looking how things are going today. I would think so, particularly when they read scriptures and says, as it was in the days of Noah, shall it be in these days. And with that in their mind and mindset, I'm certainly going to impact their frame of reference when they look at these issues.
That sounds quite likely. I think, therefore, what we're seeing is a convergence, is the ultimate convergence on the planet. On the one hand, we can be terrified by it. We can be immobilized by it. We can be destroyed by the fear of it. And on the other hand, we can ask the positive questions as well.
Mm-hmm.
What new species might arise? And how intelligent and how... and perhaps how moral that new species might be, and so on.
Mm.
So I guess I'm an American, and I come with chemical optimism.
That's right. That's right. And it's according to what sci-fi movie you watch, too. We see some have a bright future when people like that visit us, and then we have some like War of the Worlds that sort of go the other way.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I would think whatever it is, this issue makes it very tough for you when you look 30 years, 50 years down the road, to be able to polish your crystal ball very clearly, just because of this one issue.
Well, for sure. But again, time is the most difficult thing to forecast, at least for us it has been.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know whether we're talking about decades or indeed who knows what may intervene between now and then that has nothing to do with these questions, but slows them down.
Right.
Maybe the result of war or catastrophe or natural catastrophe of some kind.
And they may actually prefer paper clothing when it's all said.
Someday. See, the futurists have a magic weapon, and I've carried it with me for years. The magic weapon of the futurist, and I use it all the time, is, well, you said something was going to happen, and I said, and it hasn't. And my answer to that is, yet.
So,
yet bullet.
So time is on your side.
What's that?
Time is on your side then. Hey, I have one last quick comment from you, and then I want to focus the rest of our time on the book. I appreciate your patience with me. It's just that not every opportunity we have to get someone as esteemed as you to talk about these important issues. One last quick comment, and this is going to seem mundane compared to the biological revolution, but it's important to us here in the near term. You're talking to someone here on a low-power FM station, a special class of radio stations that were intended to be diverse and to give local communities say over the content that's broadcast for their community and to be able to have information that serves the public interest. We had an FCC meeting here from the Federal Communications Commission that we testified at in December about media consolidation. And there was an interest and an attempt to allow single companies to be able to actually own all the media outlets in individual communities.
Right.
Again, this may not be as exciting as some of the things we've talked about, but as far as the impact on society, do you think it's important when we talk about diversity in these other institutions that in our institutions that we get information, editorializing and interpretation and what comes in and what we accept as truth, do you think it's also important, too, that we need to make that a priority to use technology to keep various diverse sources like what we're using here tonight?
What little bit I recall about discussing this kind of an issue with some of the FCC former chairman was that, yes, we do want diversity in communication, but now with the net, the internet, and the new technologies, there is a wide variety of sources of information, and therefore we shouldn't worry about the local concentration. I'm for maximizing the diversity.
Okay.
And I don't see why. Are the big companies, the big the big companies that are doing what you said, are they after picking up or controlling a small station?
I'm not an expert in the field, but what the trend has been so far is that they'll actually buy up a plurality of both radio and television stations in a given community. What's really been impacted are the rural areas, because sometimes they'll only have a single radio, only location where they get emergency, weather emergency information, where that's the only way they find out about the tornado bearing down on them or other things like this, or even things as simple as farm information, conduits for them to be able to speak verbally to others. And of course, the Internet is a wonderful institution to provide all sorts of information. Unfortunately, we still have a large part of the public, for one reason or another, that it still has difficulty having access to it or maintaining access to it. And at the same point, something that I've learned as an extra dimension on my end is that, I could do a show like this on the Internet, and I could sit by myself at a terminal and not interact with anyone and do maybe a decent show. But I come down to a radio station and meet other like-minded people in my own community that I wouldn't meet, and it completely changes my approach, completely enriches the direction I go, because it actually fosters communication, interaction with people in my community.
Well, I'm strongly in favor of diversity. I think, in fact, that the new economy is improved and helped by the existence of a maximum diversity of communication.
Okay.
I think I'm for that. I don't see it as necessarily a wonderful thing to have one big conglomerate own everything.
I find we're very, very, we have more than enough information coming into our heads. The problem is having a high percentage of truth coming in.
Well, in Revolutionary Wealth, there's a whole section on truth and how we decide what is or isn't truth.
Yes.
And I haven't seen that too many places.
Well, what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, is focus the remainder of our show on your new book. And talk about that. I wanted people to be familiar enough with your way of thinking so that they'd be interested in what comes in your book. There's very few who are not familiar. When the name Toffler goes out, the light bulbs go on. But there's going to be a lot of people very excited to hear about what you've got in your new book. Just so we can transition here, can we take a very, very brief break and then focus the rest of our show on the book?
Sure.
Okay. Sure. This is another song I think you're going to enjoy. If you remember Mr. Paul Williams, the very successful composer of the 1970s, wrote Evergreen and a bunch of other musical titles. And he actually had a stint in a little psychedelic band in the late 60s before he was famous, called the Holy Mackerel. And this is a song that has a very different approach. It is a sort of an apocalyptic kind of song, but it has a utopian feel to it. And I think it gives a picture of a kind of world that you're hoping to see in the future here. So I want you to enjoy this. We're not going to play all of it because time's short. But I want you and our listeners to enjoy it. It's called 1984. And when we come back from our music for meditation, we'll be back with our next segment of Future Quake. All right, we're back to the Future Quake Show with Dr. Future and our guest, Alvin Toffler. Mr. Toffler, did you enjoy that song?
I did, but I could not make out the words.
I'll send you a copy of it. It's a very beautiful song that paints a beautiful picture, an alternative view of the future, circa 1968. You know, that year was not the best of years for people to look for a bright future.
Right, right.
And it paints a picture of people dancing and singing and enjoying life and peace and stability and old people and young people learning from old people, and just a wonderful word picture. And I want to send you a copy of that because it really, it's the kind of thing dreams are made of.
Send me the other one, too.
Okay, I sure will.
Yeah, I'd be interested in reading because I missed a lot of the wording.
I sure will. Well, you'll have something when you go on the Tonight Show next. You'll have your theme music when you step on the stage. You know, like Bob Hope, you know, always had to have his music on there. Hey, I want to jump into your book right now. We want to talk into, because
okay.
I don't want to spoil it too much for our fans out here. Most of them, if they know it's out, now that they know from us, I'm sure they're going to be there to get it. It's called Revolutionary Wealth, How It Will Be Created and How It Will Change Our Lives. But it's about much more than wealth, although that provides the primary context for it. One of the main things that, and this is going to be no surprise to people, but really you're able to put some put your arms around it and really help to process it, is this impact of what you call the famous time squeeze of people today. And basically what has evolved into they're working a third job, basically. And this has some relationship to a term that you call prosumers.
Right.
And how all sorts of free labor and money are now created in the society we have that isn't tracked by our economists.
Exactly.
Can you put the pieces there together, what I'm alluding to for our listeners?
Yeah, I think I can. That economists only measure money transactions. And so they think that when you listen on the radio or television and you get the latest news about this economy or the economy is good or this company has good fundamentals or bad fundamentals, they're only talking about measurable money, as though nothing else we do contributes to the society and to the economy. But the fact is, we do a lot of things that are productive, just as productive as what is done in the economy, but we do not get paid for doing them. There was a survey not long ago about women, and what they concluded was mothers. A mother is the kid's doctor. She puts the Band-Aid on when the knee is scraped. She's the chauffeur to drive the kid to the soccer match or whatever, wherever the kid goes. She's the cook. She's the house painter, if you need to paint the bedroom. She's this, that, and the other thing. All of these things could be done two ways. She could hire a cook. She could hire a driver. She could hire a doctor. She could hire all these other things and pay. If she did that, she would be counted as contributing to the economy. The amount of money she paid would be counted by the economists.
Right.
On the other hand, if she does those things herself, she puts the Band-Aid on, she takes the kid out, she does all of these things herself, that's not counted in the economy, even though the end condition may be exactly the same. What you have, and in the case of women, this survey recently in New York calculated that if you added up all the things a woman did, as driver, doctor, cook, and so forth and so on, she should be getting paid $134,000 a year. But that $134,000 doesn't get to her, indeed, it doesn't get measured in the economy. So her work is regarded as valueless as far as our economists are concerned, and that's what we're taught in economics, basically. But the society couldn't run without all of these things. Now, other examples: we create actual products outside the economy in what we call, in revolutionary wealth, we call it the prosumer economy. Mm-hmm. Let me explain that briefly. Pro for production, sum for consume. We're saying that the consumer is a producer as well, many times.
Mm-hmm.
And a powerful example of that, how about this? You've got a young guy sitting and working in an office in Finland, and he doesn't like his computer operating system. And so he says, you know, I could write a better one. And in his free time, without anybody paying him, no money changes hands, and almost as a hobby, he sits down and he writes a new operating system. And that operating system he then takes and throws out onto the web, at which point hundreds, maybe thousands, I don't know, of programmers are invited by him to improve it. And they do. And so far, what he's done is, and all of them have done, is contribute free labor. And by the time they're done, they've got an operating system that's so good, it makes Microsoft worry about its future, because suddenly everybody's using Linux.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, China announces that all Chinese government agencies shall heretofore use Linux, not Microsoft. And then you have companies now, many companies are building products that could only function if they were connected to Linux. So what you have is a hobby activity, an unpaid activity, not measured by the economy or the economists, but affecting the economy and then changing the economy, even of even so big an outfit as Microsoft, and changing the economics. So what we argue in Revolutionary Wealth is that we're not getting paid for a lot of the work we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's okay, but we should certainly be aware of it. Take another example. We call it the third job that you're doing. Job number one, you go to work and you get paid. That's job number one. Job number two, you come home and maybe you cook your dinner or you clean up after the dishes or you do this or that, and you're doing work, but in this case you're not getting paid for it because you are prosuming. You are creating value, the value of a cleaned house or the value of the family. You're creating that without getting paid for it. And then you wind up now. You used to go to the supermarket, and you stood in line, and some clerk stood behind the counter, and they measured your weighed your products or listed your products, and they ran up a bill for you, and you paid. Well, now, increasingly, you go into supermarkets, and you do your own. You not only pull the stuff off the shelves, you also punch in the information needed to come up with a price, and then you pay. So you're doing the job that somebody else used to be doing who is then getting paid, but you're not getting paid for it. Similarly, you used to go to the bank to cash a check. I did that
right
not long ago. I still insist on doing that. I went to the bank, and there's a teller behind the counter, usually a young woman, and you give her the check, and she asks some questions of you, and then she writes some data down, making sure you're you claim you are,
right.
And so she, and then she writes out whatever she needs and cashes the check for you. But now you go to the ATM machine. Who writes that information? You do. You
right.
Punch it into the machine. You are now doing work that the clerk in the bank used to do, but you're doing it free. Now, that doesn't mean that that ATMs are bad. We may like ATMs. Maybe we don't have to wait online as long or this or that. But it is amazing to me that after all of these years, those factors, that side of the economy, which is the hidden economy, and which some people calculate may be as big as the money economy, consists of work that we do without getting paid. So we have the third job, one the pay job, one the job around the house, and the third is doing things that other paid people used to do. In the case of the bank case example, a rough calculation suggests that there were 200,000 tellers more than we now have, that in fact the ATM machine has, and your inputs into it, have replaced something like 200,000 tellers around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Again, overall, that may not be such a terrible thing, bad for the teller, but it may be good for the economy and the society. But it is never measured or taken into account by mm-hmm. economists.
Well, how much mail do we mail ourselves via email rather than pay for postage to have our postman?
Yeah, we're doing many, many things. And, of course, we now see user-generated content on the net.
Mm-hmm.
And, Al Gore has a television station or network that encourages people to make their own television programs and send it in,
mm-hmm.
and they don't. In that case, the broadcaster doesn't have to pay to produce a product. He doesn't have to send out a team. It's the viewers who are now voluntarily creating television for it. And so, what we're seeing more and more is the growth of what we have called a prosumer economy. Again, prosumer meaning that the consumer is also the producer of a great deal of value in the system. And unless we understand this, We will never understand where the economy is going, where the jobs are going, or where it should go, and so on. What economists do, they're like a doctor who looks inside your body, and he looks at the right lung, but he doesn't even notice that there's a left lung attached to it. And that is how our present-day economics are really skewed and inaccurate.
Well, it sounds like the prosumer has some things in common with the Amish.
Look, prosuming, all of us, all of our ancestors were prosumers because
right.
There was no money. There was no money market. There was no economy. There was none of this. You shot your own food or fished for your own food. You built your own shack. You sewed your own clothes to the degree that you had any. And that was prior to the existence of money, prior to the existence of markets. But then we began to see the spread of the market system and of money, and this was tremendously valuable for the human race. I'm not putting it down in the slightest. It was extremely valuable. But at the same time, we began to think that everything is a marketable, money marketable thing. And the fact is, we not only do we prosume a lot of activity that should be counted in the economy as value creating, not only that, but we're going to do more. And one of the reasons is that the money economy, ironically, is creating technologies that we personally use, and that that we personally use to create value outside the money economy. Another example has to do with photography. When I was a kid growing up in a big city, if you wanted to take photos of your family, you first had to go to a pharmacy, a drugstore, and buy a roll of film. Then you put that in your camera, you took your pictures, and then you went back to that store with the roll of film now exposed, and you give it to the store, and they then sent it to Kodak in Rochester, New York, to be processed.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe a week later or 10 days later, you went back to the drugstore and you paid for it, and lo and behold, you had photographs. Well, now we've created the technologies that make it possible for you to do the equivalent of processing that film in the palm of your own hand.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happening is that the money economy is providing tools with which we can prosume. And that is a perfectly good thing to do.
Well, you know, it's ironic.
But it's not perfectly a good thing to do to ignore the importance of all of those things we
right.
do.
We're even
we
providing
volunteer.
Our...
I had, we have a friend who's originally a Malaysian doctor who married an Indonesian young woman. They're both ethnic Chinese, and he was a doctor. Now he's running some companies. But when the tsunami hit,
mm-hmm.
We were supposed to have dinner. He was in California, and he said, let's have dinner. And we had the dinner set, and then the phone rang, and he said, I've got to go because of the tsunami. I'm going to go volunteer in Aceh,
mm-hmm.
in Indonesia. And he went there to save babies and put the hospital back together again. Volunteer work. Volunteer work is valuable. It should be counted in the economy as worthwhile activity, just as important as work you do that you paid for.
Right.
But it's not.
Right. Well, you know, I actually volunteer here in my position here in this radio show, you know, on behalf of my community. I consider it part of my community service. Other people feel like they get what they pay for with me.
Mm-hmm.
I earn every penny on the show there. But you're exactly right. I just think that, you know, there's so many dimensions to this. A lot of businesses have pushed us into prosumer mode almost out of laziness. We've had to take on a lot of roles that they did because they cut cost. When they cut staff, they have us fill out the same paperwork and information online to buy something that someone else there would have taken care of on our behalf.
It's called externalization of labor cost.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's on our backs when we do it. As far as the volunteerism, that's still going on. But with some of the social structures that we've had that have been shaken and maybe aren't as strong with recent generations, not only within the church but other civic clubs, which people used to, you know, donate their time for community assistance.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, you mentioned the loneliness and the disassociation that people do, whether you call it nesting or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
That has had to have had some impact on the volunteerism side. of the economy. I've noticed people tend to be a little bit more aloof now. There's still plenty of volunteerism going on, don't get me wrong.
Well, I can tell you, Heidi's life was saved by volunteer firemen.
Is that right?
Yes, it was. No doubt about it.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, that's good to hear. We actually had some volunteer firemen at our home over a defective carbon monoxide detector going off the other evening. So there are some volunteers that are
but
more
that
critical.
Wasn't counted as value to the economy.
No, it wasn't written anywhere. And, you know, they collect their money in all sorts of novel ways that never come across the economic scale to buy their equipment and things like that. But the leaping from that and acknowledging that into the crux of your book being the opportunities for newfound wealth in the world of the future, how do we go from that reality?
Before we get to that specific, let me say something about knowledge.
Okay.
We talk about a knowledge economy, but most people don't fully understand how critical that is and how different it is from any economy we've been taught about in school.
Okay.
For example, in a standard economy that we're accustomed to, assets or goods, if I use them, you can't. If I use it, you can't. If I eat the meal, you can't eat the meal, etc. But in a knowledge economy, when knowledge becomes a resource, I can use knowledge, you can use the same knowledge. And in fact, not only doesn't it go away, we can make more out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You use arithmetic, it doesn't use it up for me. So knowledge is an input into the economy, which is what the economists now call non-rival. You know, they don't rival mm-hmm. one another. We don't rival one another by using it. Secondly, it's intangible. You can't touch it. You can touch oil. You can touch other resources into the economy. You know, they used to call economics the science of the allocation of scarce resources. But knowledge is not a scarce resource because it doesn't get used up.
Mm-hmm.
It's intangible. It's nonlinear so that a tiny insight, a tiny idea can yield huge outputs. It's relational, by which I mean it only has meaning when it's placed in some larger context. It's sexy. In the sense that it mates with other knowledge, and it's more portable than any other resource. It's bits and bytes that you can transmit easily, cheaply. It can be compressed. Try compressing a toaster, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It can be stored in smaller and smaller spaces. It can be explicit or implicit. It can be tacit or shared, expressed or not expressed. It's hard to bottle up, and it spreads. So this is a new it's not a new resource, but it's an increasingly important input into the economy. And when we talk about knowledge workers, we're talking about people working with this kind of material. And we're not used to it. We're used to the factory, the assembly line, the physical goods, the automobile, the steel, the oil, etc. And the revolution that this knowledge is introducing into the economy has only just begun. It's amazing what it is doing to not just the U.S. economy, but to the world economy.
Hmm. Okay. Getting into the aspect of taking the benefits of the knowledge economy, how does this translate, as I was originally alluded to, into sources of newfound wealth that if we grasp this completely, we're able to capitalize, you know, for our own benefit and that of our families with this?
Well, I think
or for our community as a whole.
Well, I think there are many, many things that are going to happen. There's no doubt that the rise of the knowledge economy, or what we call a third wave economy, first wave was the spread of agriculture for hunting and gathering. Agriculture. The second wave of change was the Industrial Revolution, and we're now living through a third historic wave of change. And there's no question about it. When a new wave of change like that, on that scale, that historic scale, comes along, you have both winners and losers from that. And you frequently have conflict between them.
Mm-hmm.
You frequently, if you read the press today, read the newspaper or magazines on the news of the world, you frequently find, you know, there's a battle or a coup d'etat taking place in Thailand or this or that or the other thing, and you read down in the depths of the article, and suddenly you see, well, the rural people support this guy, but the urban people support that guy.
Right.
there is a continuing hostility between urban and rural values and attitudes that began with the Industrial Revolution and that has been with us ever since. So there is a set of different, frequently different values, and now this is, goes away with time, but in fact still exists strongly in many, many countries around the world. In the U.S., I think it's not quite as strong as elsewhere. But that's a, what we call wave conflict. It's a conflict between the people who live with the second wave or industrial standards and values and so forth, and those who still cling to some rural sort of older values and so on. And now you've got the third wave coming along, and it is shaking everything up.
Right.
And people no longer understand what it is. And I think what we're seeing in the emergence of this new wealth system, and again, I thank you for saying revolutionary wealth is not just about money. It's just it's about our society and our daily lives.
Right.
It's about everything from family sex to kids in school or kids being deprived of education.
Right. Wealth and prosperity is very multifaceted.
And so I think that we're going through this enormous upheaval, and people are therefore, as we said earlier on the show, are increasingly uncertain about their future. They know that something's happening, but not one of our politicians ever discusses this or faces it. In fact, what's happening is that all the boundaries that we had in our lives and the roles that we play are breaking down. Every social system, every society has a role structure. What that means is, you know, your role as a father is different from your role as a job.
Mm-hmm.
You have the role of a doctor, you have the role of a nurse, you have the role of a teacher, you have the role of a student. These people are supposed to, are expected to behave in certain ways when they're in these various categories. And that's all something that kids learn in the school without anybody ever even teaching it to them. So there's a role structure. That role structure is breaking down in American society. That is, the role of the nurse vis-a-vis the doctor is changing. The role of the paralegal versus the lawyer is changing. The role of the teacher versus student, whether the teacher likes it or not, is changing. And so forth. So what we're seeing is the breakdown of the traditional role structure in the society. And on top of that, we also have in every society, and especially in ours, we have a structure of boundaries that are hidden, but they're part of our lives. In academia, that's very clear. There's a boundary between the math department and the English department.
Mm-hmm.
And information is channeled according to those different boundaries. Well, there are boundaries in every field. There are boundaries in music. There are boundaries in every activity that we engage. There's some sort of boundary. And what's happening is these boundaries, which were designed largely influenced by the rise of the industrial way of life, people going and getting up at the same time, going to work at the factory at the same time, doing rote and repetitive work, coming home at the same time, living a certain way, that with the breakdown of that and the shift toward a knowledge-based economy and more white-collar work, more and more engineering and science and so forth and so on, you're getting the breakdown of the boundaries. And what's happening also, with the breakdown of boundaries, it's unclear very often where you should be or what you should do and so forth. And people are testing the limits of boundaries. In what you're seeing in academia, of course, the breakdown is reflected healthily, I think, in the shift from narrow specialties to studies that are done across the boundaries.
Right, multidisciplinary
of academic
type
disciplines, transdisciplinary work.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think is happening in our society is that people are uncertain about where the new boundaries are, and they are testing the limits of the old boundaries, and they're testing the definition, for example, of a family. Is a gay couple with kids a family? I think yes, but maybe somebody else thinks no. But that's being tested in our society today, politically, and in the courts and so forth and so on. And I think that's just one example of barriers that are being broken all along the line as people test them. And then you have some people who test them creatively and some people who test them with crime. Everybody is saying, mm-hmm. how far can I go? But sometimes going far means doing good, and sometimes it means doing bad.
Right.
So I think you have a great uncertainty, a high level of uncertainty in American life today, which is the consequence of the testing of the established boundaries and the uncertainty about what our role should be in this new system. So that all of what's happening goes far beyond money and far beyond economics. And that is why we call it the emergence of a new civilization. And revolutionary wealth lies behind this and is pushing this new system, or demanding new institutions, new values, new ways of dealing with each other. And that's what the book's about.
Okay. Let me ask you to, we've talked about a lot of influences, but let's say you have an audience of all of the high school juniors around the country that have lots of hard decisions to make about their career, about other decisions beyond simple vocations or their paths that they take, and you're giving you're going to prepare a commencement address to them that you're going to have eventually. What kind of advice can you give them to set them on a proper path to be prepared, both career wise and in other aspects of their life for the totality of the wealth of their life? What kind of specifics can you give that they need to be preparing for, looking at directions they need to look, opportunities that exist on the horizon?
Well, the first thing I think that I would say is there's no one formula.
Okay.
There can't be one formula. We're moving into a world of greater diversity than ever in social structure. And therefore, we're going to need all kinds of different people with different kinds of skills and so forth. And that at that age, also, it's very hard to know where you're going to wind up. I knew I wanted to be a writer, and did wind up as a writer. But before that, I wound up as a welder and a worker on the automobile assembly line, and as a many, many other things. And there was those many different things that came together to make it possible for me to be a writer. So first of all, I think kids, what's wrong with our education system? Primarily, we're wrong with it, is its treatment of one, it's basically one size fits all.
Mm-hmm.
And that was okay when everybody was going to wind up in a factory doing
right.
the same kind of work. You might be a different factory, but you're still doing rote and repetitive work, and you have to show up on time, again, because if you're late, you screw up the work of 10,000 people on the other end of the assembly line. So I think that we're seeing a much freer, much more diverse future available to the kids growing up today. But by that token, also much more confusing. But there are going to be, I think industries, and it's a bad word to use, but that is the word that we're accustomed to, with new kinds of products and new kinds of services, with a wide variety of opportunities for kids to discover. And in the book, Revolutionary Wealth, we list a bunch of these.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of searching for the paragraph that summarizes them.
You know, it seems to me, when you talk about institutions, that even looking to centers of learning to be able to, quote, get educated is something that's becoming rapidly obsolete. I'm a big believer in formal education.
Mm-hmm.
I have a number of degrees and a major portion of my life in post-secondary education. And sometimes it's if nothing more than getting your ticket punched and letting people know you're serious about your field that you're in. However, if I stopped at only what I learned in college, even up through my doctoral work, and used that as a means by which to make myself valuable to the world around me, I would be in severe difficulty. And I find with the Internet right now and with sources where you have ad hoc groups getting together that have like interest, and you mentioned about people having diverse backgrounds. I have an interest in ancient manuscripts and understanding history of different things, and there's diverse groups that I'm in that most of these people have engineering or science backgrounds, not related to English or linguistics. There are others that I'm involved with that are involved in leading some highly technical groups that are English majors, like yourself, or other kind of non-technical. We have a agricultural science professor with no science background that led a bunch of farm students to set a land speed record in a hydrogen vehicle they developed with no formal background in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm seeing more and more diversity of people cross-training in different areas, and what's bringing them together is an ad hoc common interest for the time being. And the Internet provides an ideal forum for people like that around the world to get together and to basically end up educating each other rather than just purely a teacher-student role. Do you see that as something that's going to take more and more of a role as opposed to the formal education?
You see, I think everybody's talking about the need today for innovation and creativity, and I think that is correct. But you don't get that without diversity. And you get more. I mean, if you got if you got guys working on a particular product or a particular problem, bringing in somebody from a completely different field brings with it frequently creative new ideas. The application of a model that worked in one field may be twisted a little bit, may be terrific for use in yours, and so on. So I think that cross-disciplinary activity is very healthy. I think that not all learning takes place in schools. And think about this. In 1975 or so, we bought one of the very first PCs to exist. At that time, if you wanted to buy, it didn't apply to us, but if you wanted to buy a PC when they first began to appear, you you went to Radio Shack.
Right.
And Radio Shack had 16-year-old kids behind the counter with pimples on their face selling everything. And they said that we got this crazy new machine out here. It's really wonderful. And then you bought it, but you didn't know how to use it. So you asked them, and they said, well, you punch these buttons, and you went home, and you punched three or four buttons, and you said, well, okay, I can do that, but then it's not much. I need to know more. You go back to the store. The kid gives you a few more thoughts, and and still you're unhappy.
Right.
Finally, it becomes clear you need a guru. You need a computer guru. Who's a guru? A guru is whoever bought a machine 1 week before you did.
That's exactly right.
And what happened is that at a time, there was a time when nobody knew how to use a laptop. And now we probably have 90 million people or, I don't know, 100 million people who use them every day. And they didn't learn how to do that in school. They learned basically from reading or from each other.
Right.
In fact, I learn from each other all the time about how to use my own computer. So not all education takes place in the school. A lot of education that is of extreme value to the community, to the economy, including the one I just mentioned, takes place outside any formal learning institution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things we should see in the future is schools breaking open and bringing in people from the community to help kids learn this or that, or allowing kids to go out. And we had, there was an experimental school set up in Long Island many years ago called the Toffler-Maslow School. And one of the things they did at the high school level is they let the kids go out and work in community organizations. And one kid, for example, went out and said, wanted to be a cop. And so they arranged for him to do some volunteer work at the police. Came back and said, well, I'm not sure I want to be a cop. Maybe I want to be something else. Well, that's valuable. That's when you learn what you don't want to do.
That's right.
That's very valuable.
That's right.
And so on. So there's a great deal of learning. In fact, most of what we learn is not in classrooms.
That's right.
And we're going to have to revolutionarily transform the education system that we have, which was a wonderful system for producing what was known as, quote, industrial discipline.
Mm-hmm.
That is an inappropriate discipline for today. We need discipline, obviously, but not to create factory workers because the jobs ain't going to be there.
Mr. Toffler, I hate to say, I've kept you much longer than I intended. I thank you for your patience, and our time is up for tonight. But I want to make sure to tell our listeners where they can get your new book called Revolutionary Wealth, How It Will Be Created and How It Will Change Our Lives. Can you please tell us quickly? It's being published by...
The paperback, which is just out, is published by Doubleday. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it in any major bookstore.
Well, I can tell you most of our listeners are quite conversant with Amazon, I'm sure, out there. So I will meet all of you at Amazon. You'll want to get a copy not only for yourself to read, but for you to keep for your kids and grandchildren. This is something that they'll want to read when they get old enough to grasp the concepts, and that means they don't have to be that old to be able to do that. But it's something that you'll want to keep on the shelf, just like Future Shock and a Third Wave. No library will be complete without having a copy of this on its shelf. And I want to thank you so much for all of your time and patience, much more than I expected. And I certainly want to let you know you have a standing invitation to come back to Future Quake anytime
Radio
you get
Free
an
Nashville,
opportunity.
Radio Free Nashville, 98.9
WRFN. Thank you for the opportunity, and it's a pleasure to have an intelligent person to talk with. And